I'm Mike Shaver, and this is Mike Ang, and we're going to talk about Mozilla, that's right, some of the technology and architecture that we're using to build the software, stuff that's outlined in the paper and so forth. I'm going to start talking a little bit about the history of the project, where we are today, how we got there. Then we're going to talk about some of the technologies in order there, information you'd need to port Mozilla to a new platform, if there are any left, and then some stuff that was only told to me as I was writing the paper and slides.
Earlier today.
Thank you. As most of you are probably aware, Netscape released the source code to its communicator product through Mozilla.org on March 31st, 1998. Some of you may have looked at that code. I must apologize. It had served us well for many years, but as people kept telling us, and as actually engineers within Netscape, it was not a terribly surprising discovery. Code was a little bit unwieldy to work with, harder to port than needed to be. A lot of issues related to legacy layout constraints and that sort of thing. A fair amount of hacking was done on it. Some good features came in, trying to get mail news code integrated from Netscape. That never materialized. So in November of 98, people started to talk about maybe a better way to do things. And we had a really promising prototype of a new layout engine, then called Raptor, now called a bunch of other things, ng-layout and Gecko. So crazy talk started to float around the Mozilla project about how we should maybe look at building our browser on top of this technology. We've always talked about being able to build real applications using web standards, and maybe we should look into doing that. So we looked into doing it, and we liked what we saw. In addition to the fact that it made a lot of our technical jobs easier, there was a fair amount of clamor in newsgroups and mailing lists and the press for better standard support, both in Netscape's product and in the competition. That standard support would have been very difficult to provide with the old code base. The document object model, proper HTML4 using the widget constraints we were under there, very difficult. I worked on the DOM and style sheets for some number of weeks, and it was pretty intractable. So we had this great engine, and it did HTML4, and it did CSS1, and it did XML, and DOM, and other acronym happy things. And it was also an easier code base to hack on. It had been written more recently, not quite as organic in appearance. We'd be able to take advantage of the things we learned about cross-platform development over the course of the first four versions of Communicator and Navigator, which were considerable lessons and considerably painful to learn. So we threw it all away, all the front-end stuff. We have a new layout engine. We started to build this cross-platform front-end called XPFE. It's all XML. It's all HTML. It's all very whiz-bang, and it's pretty quick. So people were pretty happy with that. Started over then, and we're progressing down that path. So today's talk is going to describe where we are along that, the kind of things we're using to build that software, and some of what's happening in the near future.
All right, so now I'm going to talk a bit about the cross-platform object model. And basically, one of the problems with the old code base was that the boundaries between different modules weren't very clear. A lot of the code had strange interactions, and if you wanted to add some new feature, you really had to understand a very complex flow of control and understand basically how everything worked together. So part of XPCOM's goal is to break the browser down into smaller modules with clearly defined boundaries. And this way, it'll be easier to get up to speed on what you need to do. And also, you'll just be able to focus on the area of the browser that you want to enhance. And so one of the reasons we're using XPCOM, again, is for modularity, pluggability. We want to make it easy to write plugins that can interact very deeply with the browser and add a lot of new functionality. And we also want to guard against problems with binary format stability. We want to make it easy for people to compile plugins using possibly their own compilers, or maybe they're using the same compiler as we're using, EGCS on Unix platforms, but they're using slightly different flags, and we want to make sure that we keep things stable, and that'll be a good story for when we want to move to downloading DLLs off the web or something to upgrade the browser with new functionality. And also, what XPCOM is going to give us is interlanguage capability, so you'll be able to write components in other languages. Right now, the one we're supporting is JavaScript, and possibly in future, Java. There's some work being done there. And so actually be able to write your components in different languages, and that'll all be transparent when you're using it. So the way we achieve this is by making a very strong separation between interface and implementation. So this way, all the details of the implementation, even down to like the language of implementation, is hidden. And this encapsulation lets us, makes it possible to upgrade in the future and not have any problems with incompatibilities. For example, you can even change the size of your class, and it won't affect previous memory allocations. For example, if in version 1, you had this string class that took a certain amount of space, like 4 bytes or something, and then later on you want to upgrade to something that's 8 bytes, well, you need to be able to do that without breaking the code from the beginning, even though you need more memory. And so by separating the implementation from the interface, this can be achieved. And so the way it works in C++ is that the interface description is actually a separate class from the class implementation itself. And so when you want to use a component, you just need to bind against the interface, and you don't know anything about the implementation. And so each interface is given a unique ID, which is known as the interface ID, IID. And a given component can expose several different interfaces. And the way you get at these different interfaces is using a call called query interface, which is similar to what a dynamic cast would be in C. So you may have this object, and it might expose a widget interface, just saying have a method called paint or something. And you may also have a specific interface for a scroll box, if it's a scroll box. And so the way you create objects is using create instance and using class ID. And the reason you need a difference between an interface ID and a class ID is because a given implementation class could expose several different interfaces. And the class ID is really like a serial number for a very specific implementation. And so the interface ID is sort of a more general way of getting at an object by specifying what behavior you want. And a class ID can be used if you need this exact implementation. So use of class IDs is actually kind of discouraged. And it's class IDs are basically used by the runtime system to map. You can ask for a certain component in a generic way, and the class ID is used internally to find the exact implementation that will be used. And because you can access your objects through many different interfaces, we use a reference counting scheme so that it's easy to keep track of the lifetime of objects. So it makes it an easy rule when you're using objects. Whenever you get a new interface pointer, the reference count on the underlying object goes up by 1, and when you want to release that and stop using that pointer, you simply call release, and that decrements the reference count. And what this does is it also hides another implementation detail, because you don't even know if your object is actually allocated on the heap or on the stack. So it means that whether or not the object is in memory that's going to go away after the program ends, or it could even be in a ROM, you don't know, and you don't need to know, and it doesn't make any difference. So it means that, for example, for small devices, this can be very useful, because you can implement an object in static memory, and the person who's using that doesn't even need to know that detail, and it's just the same as using any other object. So basically, part of XVCOM is just to try and encapsulate all the implementation details, so the coder just has to worry about what they want to do as opposed to what the underlying implementation is. And another way we sort of decouple XVCOM from using C++ specifically is by using a different language for defining interfaces, the interface definition language, IDL. And that basically describes all the methods of your on your interface and all the parameter types. And it's not specific to C++, so that means it can be used on other systems and compiled, even if you don't have a C++ compiler, for example. And this is necessary to support other languages, such as JavaScript. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about XVCOM techniques, things that you would need to use to fully benefit from XVCOM. And part of problem with XVCOM is that it's built in the C++ world. It's built on top of C++, and the rules aren't necessarily enforced by the compiler. So you do need to know a lot of the rules of COM to be able to use it properly. For example, you need to know when you need to add a reference, when you need to release a reference. So knowing the techniques of XVCOM will help you to write good code. And some of the things that are available to help with that are aggregation. And basically what aggregation means is that you can have two separate implementation classes that appear as a single object to the end user. So the user might just say, give me this GIF renderer, And maybe part of the renderer is implemented in one module and part of it's in a different module. For example, you know, loading it over the network might be implemented in the network library, and the rendering is going to be somewhere else. And what aggregation does is it allows you to expose a single entry point to these two separate objects that are implemented in different places and do that transparently using the interface IDs. And also, talking earlier about the adding and releasing references, that can be a little bit tricky to understand, and so we've added a smart pointer class called NSComPointer, which takes care of a lot of these, takes care of a lot of the adding and releasing references automatically. It says here on the slide that it also handles doing automatic query interfaces, and that's actually no longer true. It was changed a few days ago. Part of the problem we've had while doing our slides and our paper is that a lot of these things are moving targets. We've got this one developer, Dave Hyatt, who's doing, in this case, it's Scott Collins who's working on XBCOM, and they keep coding at this tremendous pace, and sometimes it's hard to keep up. Sometimes I think we need to like tie up some of our developers, a few days before conferences just to let everything settle down for at least a couple days. So in using NSComPointer, that helps a lot. Basically, with NSComPointer, you probably won't have to call addref and release explicitly. It'll be done automatically. You just declare it normally as you would a variable, and once that leaves scope, then the object will be released. I mentioned earlier the interface description language. We call that XBIDL. We like adding XB in front of everything to make sure that everyone remembers it's cross-platform and it works everywhere, not just on specific platforms. And so using from the interface description language files, you can generate headers for C++ so that you can call it from C++. And also you can generate type libraries, which are basically just a version of the interface that's been compiled down to a very, very small form that's very efficiently parsed. And this allows you to have the interface information available to other languages, such as JavaScript, soon Java, and possibly other languages as well. Okay, so I'm just going to talk a little bit about NSComPointer and also just sort of general XBCOM techniques. What we see here is accessing an object using XBCOM and calling a method on it. And so you can see at the top, you declare ifu. Basically, in XBCOM, whenever you access an object, you only ever do it through the interface. So you only know about ifu as opposed to actually the foo implementation. And so you use the I prefix to designate that that's an interface as opposed to the actual underlying implementation object. And the create ifu is a helper method that will create one of those objects. And then after that, with the NS succeeded, you need to check the status and make sure that it was correct. And so after that, what you want to do is, if you see on the line where it says foo query interface, what we're doing there is we're taking this object that we've created through that ifu pointer, and we're now going to access it as if it was a bar object. So you need to do a query interface to do it as a bar, and that's sort of like a dynamic cast in C++. And so then you continue on. We actually then cast it to a different pointer. I guess we could have made this example a little bit simpler. But anyway, once we get down to foo bar, we have now accessed that object using a foo bar interface pointer, and we can call the method on the foo bar pointer, which is do the really hard thing. And so then after that, what we need to do is that each time we have gotten an interface pointer to the object as a different interface, the reference count on the underlying object has been increased by one. And so now that we're done with these pointers, you can see that there's these three calls to release, which tells XBCOM that we're done with these objects and accessing through these pointers, and it can possibly free this object, or if other people are still using it, it'll still be around. And so that obviously is a little bit complex. So now we can see the example with NSComPointer, so on the next page, and we can see that this is a fair amount simpler. You can see that immediately the calls to release are gone. And basically using the NSComPointer, and it's actually a template, you can access these objects very simple. It's a lot closer to what you would normally do in C++ or C. And then once your interface pointer leaves scope, then release is called automatically. And this also solves some problems too, where if you make an assignment into your ifu pointer, then release is called, and then the new pointer value is put in. Again, there's a lot more examples up on Mozilla.org, so if this was a little bit too confusing, then, or if I didn't explain it correctly is what I'm more getting at, then those examples are up there. There's also plenty of knowledgeable people who are quite willing to answer any questions you may have. And there's a lot of news groups. There's links to those that are in the paper that we did. All right, so now we're going to talk about components and services. And basically, these are just these are use XPCOM, and these are just sort of the way that in Mozilla that you access XPCOM objects, and they're sort of like we have certain managers to keep track of all our different objects. And so with factories, you can basically just ask for you can ask for a factory that creates these different objects. You don't even need to know what the specific class ID is, and you can just ask for these things. And factories are just another level of encapsulation that that separates you from the underlying implementation. And with components, what we have are you can ask for specific components. So instead of having to ask for this 32-bit number that identifies an interface ID, you can actually use a string instead, which just is like you want to ask for components :// Netscape GIF render, for example. And the component manager keeps track of when to free objects, and so you need to access all of your components through the component manager, and all calls to create instance are ferried through the component manager, and it keeps track of when to create new objects and when to free them. So all calls to create XPCOM objects must go through the component manager. It is possible for you to auto-register your components to the runtime, and basically what you do is you put your component into a shared library, and you have a certain method on that in that library, and then when Mozilla starts up and when it wants to populate this registry, then what it'll do is it'll call that method in your library, and it'll say, okay, tell me all the components you know about, and the library will say, okay, I know about this component, I know about this component, and these are the names of the components. So this makes it possible for people to create, say, for example, plugins or components that will be accessed later and actually add them to Mozilla after it's been shipped already, and you don't need to recompile the entire application. You can just add these in to a certain directory, and they'll be added automatically. The service manager is used to keep track of objects that will be running for the lifetime of the program. For example, you might have a certain service to load images over the network, and if there's only one of those, then that will be handled by the service manager. And using the service manager, you can say, all right, I want to put a lock on that, and I want to have the access to that now. And all right, now it's time to release it so that other people can use it. So service manager is really used to keep track of objects and services that will be used for the lifetime of the program, whereas the component manager is used to create one-off objects that you're going to be using. I mentioned before you could use a string instead of a class ID to ask for a specific object. And the way class IDs and IIDs work is they're actually universally unique IDs. So it's a 32-bit number that uniquely identifies that. It's generated based on like your hardware Ethernet address, the current time, and so those are unique. But unfortunately, they're not very human readable. This huge string of numbers is not very you don't want to ask for 056A-whatever. Instead, we want to probably be able to ask for it in a much more human-readable manner. So basically, what a prog ID is just a string representation of a class ID, and you can ask for those instead of having to use this opaque number. Okay, so now we're going to give an example of XP Connect. And what XP Connect does is it allows you to interoperate seamlessly with JavaScript. So from JavaScript, you can create XPCOM objects, and you can also call from XPCOM into JavaScript and manipulate, and JavaScript can implement objects through XPCOM. And so we see here in the first line, we access the interface that we want using the components object, which is a global object in JavaScript that you can use to access interface IDs. And so then we see the next line, we create an instance of an object using a prog ID. My prog ID is just a simple string which is mapped by the component manager into a specific implementation. And so we create an instance of that, and so obj now holds an instance of that object. And then we query interface using the interface ID so we can access it through that specific NSI foo interface. And in the next line, we see that you can call from JS, the call from JS to XBCOM, and it's to the JavaScript programmer, they don't even know necessarily that it's implemented in XBCOM. And this is really powerful because it lets the JavaScript programmers call into XBCOM without having to worry about the details of, you know, add ref, release. And you can implement components that will be accessible to JavaScript very easily if you already have an existing XBCOM component. So this means that a huge amount of the browser is accessible through JavaScript, to privileged JavaScript, that is, because most of the modules have XBCOM interfaces around them. And so the way XBCOM, the way XBConnect works, rather, is we use the typelib files, and if you recall, those are a parsed version of the interface files, which talk about, you know, method signatures and parameters. And those are used so that JavaScript can call into XBCOM. And what we do is we need to, you know, fake up a vtable so all the method calls are correct. And the source code for all this is available, so you can actually delve much further into the details if you're so inclined. And because these typelib files have a specific format that's out there, and it's not specific to a particular binding. The typelib files aren't specific to the binding of XBCOM and C++ or XBCOM and JavaScript. It's possible to actually allow other languages to call into XBCOM using the same type of, you know, vtable fake up that's used for JavaScript. And right now, some Sun engineers are actually looking at that to allow XBCOM and Java to interoperate. And if you've got, you know, your own favorite language, you can actually do this, and it's not too hard. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the user interface, sort of the top layer. And previously, in the user interface, you would have to define everything in C++. And there was actually a separate front end for the different platforms. There's a front end on Windows, front end on Unix, and front end on Mac. And these were actually completely separate code bases, where, while at the same time, the functionality that they provided was really the same. I mean, drawing a combo box on one platform is really the same as on another platform. But of course, the different front-end libraries we were using had, you know, subtle incompatibilities. You know, a drop-down list on one platform doesn't look quite the same as another one, or doesn't work quite the same. And so what we wanted to do is to actually try and eliminate all that duplicated code. And so we introduced what's called the XPFE, cross-platform front-end. And so we're trying to take all the common functionality from the different front ends and really merge those into a single front end. And instead of writing C++ that's specific to each platform, instead you can be able to use web standards such as XML, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to do your user interface, and also to do the behavior of that user interface, not just how it looks. And so the way you do that is using Zool, which is our XML-based user interface language, which is kind of hard to say, and we didn't even condense it down to the right letters. But anyway, in the end, you can pronounce it Zool, which I think is really the point of the whole exercise. And basically, what Zool is it's an XML dialect, which is, you know, there's standard parsers out there, and supports castigating style sheets with some special properties, and you can also intersperse HTML and JavaScript. And what this lets you do is you can access these widgets that we've created that are accessible on all platforms. They're actually drawn by Mozilla using the 2D graphics abstraction layer that we've done. And so your user interface, if you use these XPFE widgets, you're guaranteed that they're going to look the same on all platforms and that the functionality is the same. And it also means that the engineers maintaining this code know they've got control over all the code that's drawing the widgets, so they can do the same thing on all platforms. And this is very important where the underlying toolkits on a specific platform don't support features that we need to support things in CSS and HTML4. A particular example is alpha transparencies. Transparency, for example, in text boxes isn't supported on many platforms by the native widget set, so instead we've decided to draw those text boxes ourselves so that we can support things like, you know, having a background images in text box, and also things like animated backgrounds, which I'm sure, like the blink tag, will only be used for good purposes and tastefully. Another feature of Zool is that we can use, it supports localization right in the code for the UI. So if you want, you can have that code, you can have your localization, your strings for different languages in the same file or in external files. And we wanted to build that in right from the ground level, so it's very easy to localize Mozilla, so that you don't just have it in English, and other languages are distant cousins. You can actually have all languages be equal, and it makes it a lot easier to maintain Mozilla for different languages. We also allow things such as overlays for UI merging. This is a new feature just added in the last couple days. Before I got my names a bit confused, but this is Dave Hyatt, who's just been churning through the code, and we've been writing up some example code, and it's just like, we'll get this little, you see this posting on the news group, I changed all the tree widget stuff, it's now a lot better, it's a lot faster, and we're like, okay, well, now our example doesn't work. So it's unfortunate for us, but it is good that a lot of work is being done on this, and it is a bit of a moving target, but it's all moving forward, too, which is good. So unfortunately, I can't really tell you the exact syntax of overlays, except that they exist, and that if you ask on the news group nicely, that people will tell you how they work. As I said before, you can intersperse HTML in your user interface and into your Zool file. And so this means that people who are more accustomed to designing web interfaces, there's a lot of web interfaces sort of hacked together out there on the web. You've got your shopping cart, which and the box you fill in doesn't quite do the right thing you want it to do. Well, now with Zool, you'll be able to write JavaScript code that has access to many services in the browser, because your JavaScript code through XP Connect can access XP.com and get to the bottom layer where all of this, a lot of the functionality exists. So inside your Zool file, you can sprinkle HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, which many people are familiar with. A lot more people who are designing user interfaces, especially for the web, know HTML and JavaScript compared to C++. So this will allow user interface development to be spread among a lot more people out there, and it also makes it very easy to add features to the browser that require some UI. In the old code base, if you wanted to add a button on a toolbar, and I know there was a specific example where people were trying to do this, and they gave up because it was too hard to figure out exactly how everything worked. Well, now with Zool, all you need to know is some HTML and some JavaScript, and you can pretty much do anything that you want. Okay, so that finishes up Zool.
Turn your microphone. Bug me.
So I'm going to talk about RDF, which is the Resource Description Framework, a recent standard from the World Wide Web Consortium. It's designed to express related resources in sort of a graph-based model, graph in the mathematical sense, not in terms of pie charts. We use it within Mozilla as the lingua franca of all of our data sources. I'll give you a list of them later. Wherever we have data that's hierarchical or may need to be correlated against other types of data, we use RDF because it provides a lot of valuable services for us underneath. The basic premise of RDF, it describes relations. It calls them assertions because it's a much more mathematical and academic-sounding term, between resources or nodes.
Node. Well,
more than one, actually. So built on top of that notion of relationships between different resources, it allows us to merge and sort and search between different data sets. So the canonical example I give is you can have now these super bookmarks where you could have a GNOME bookmark, for example, which would have interesting messages from your mail folder on the GNOME list, which have news articles from Slashdot and other services related to GNOME. It could have CVS messages. It can have bug reports and so forth, all correlated in one spot. It'll get updated as those data sources get updated. In addition to providing all these nice runtime services, there's a standardized syntax based on XML for serializing RDF, which is handy for doing stable storage and for allowing programs that use RDF to communicate their graphs. So you can build RDF on the server side and ship it to the client. It'll be rendered appropriately, and you can perform all sorts of interesting operations on it. Careful. So we use RDF for everything in Mozilla. Anything you ever see in a little tree widget, and I'll show it to you later, came from RDF at some point. And you can also do stuff. Menus come from RDF. Select boxes now, I think, in some cases come from RDF, although I'm not exactly sure if that's working yet. Examples of stuff we use here, bookmarks, mail folders, news groups, remote site maps. There's a section on, if you've used Mozilla recently, there's this window on the left. I'm not supposed to call it the sidebar, but I will. I'm such a bad boy. Which has a section for site maps. And as you browse a site, there's a link tag that can be used to associate an RDF file or dynamically generated, whatever, with that site, and you can use the sidebar to navigate that RDF data and merge it with other things, news groups, and so forth. We have the local file system is basically hierarchical, except on the Macintosh, where everything's a little bit different. But we can pretend it's mostly hierarchical, and so we reflect that into RDF as well. So you can have a local directory that's in your bookmarks and so forth, maybe where you get your downloads or your GNOME CVS tree locally, browser history, a lot of other stuff like that. There are about 12 RDF data sources built into Mozilla now, and a handful that come from other sources. These are the ones that are interesting and didn't require a lot of context. So how does RDF work? Basically, RDF builds graphs from multiple data sources, and it does that by asking, given a resource, www.ottawalinuxsymposium.org, or a shorter resource, it will ask each data source for assertions, which are essentially properties or things it knows about this resource. So my bookmarks RDF data source might know, okay, there's a bookmark to this for the schedule. You should merge that in there. My news group thing might say, here's the posting from Andrew about the new schedule or about the kickoff. We got a link to results from a search engine, list all the parties, that sort of thing. And RDF will collect all of those assertions and merge them in the tree, so that you'll be able to use a common UI to navigate them. You don't have to know which data source it comes from. So as you navigate down the tree, we've got the right slide too. It will follow whatever data source gave it that assertion. So it merges all that stuff. We have a naming issue there, because if you've got multiple data sources, they're going to have different meanings for things like directory. Could be which directory, which LDAP directory it came from, which online directory it came from. Could be which directory you found it in on the local file system. So rather than just use simple strings, although they're treated that way internally, the convention is to use URIs to name assertions. Also, it means you can put your URL in more places and generally hype yourself. So you'll see most name assertions will look something similar to what you see on the slide there, which is basically a URL-like thing with a suffix indicating the assertion type or property name you're really dealing with. Everything to the left of the hash mark typically describes a vocabulary, which is a convention for describing related resources. There's a handful of them. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And they all have sets of names and properties that they deal with. One of the interesting things about RDF is that it can deal in both positive and negative assertions. And that's obvious, so I'll move to the next point. No. This means that because of the way the merging works, you can, in addition to adding resources to the graph, you can overlay them with a negative assertion, which essentially removes them from the graph. So if you were to browse Yahoo, or NetCenter, I suppose, via the RDF sitemap, you might decide you never wanted to see a certain category. And you could do that by having a local RDF store, probably expressed in XML, merged on top of it. And in addition to adding different things you wanted to appear under your Yahoo tree, you could say, I never really care about, Italian sports. I never want to see that category. Or I want to see the current movie listings moved out from lower in the tree up to the top, where I'll get to it all the time. And that happens without any cooperation from the site, because they wouldn't cooperate. They don't want to remove categories. But as far as the user is concerned, you can get pretty well customized data. One of the interesting applications people are developing on top of this now is shared calendaring. Everybody's got sort of different roles they play. So you'll have, for example, I'll have a calendar for work. I'm going to talk about conferences I'm going to and things I've overdue on and that sort of thing. I'll have maybe one that I share with my family. I should talk about outings we're going to have, people's birthdays, that I should call my mom every Sunday. Be one for entertainment. I may get a calendaring a calendar data set from Paramount listing all of their new releases and the dates they open. And I can display that all in one common UI, and I'll be able to see whichever sets I want at any given time. And if my family updates that data set, I'll see that right away. And we can share data arbitrarily that way. People are doing shared bookmark stuff with that too, which I guess is probably going to see more use. And in addition to being able to add and remove resources, you can add and remove entire data sources. So you can say, I'm on vacation, I don't want to see any of my work calendar anymore, or I'm not talking to my mom anymore, remove all the entries she put in there, I'm never going to call her again. I love my mom dearly, I'm just kidding, of course. So how do you work with all of this fancy data that's aggregated for you? I'm going to do this slide in reverse order. There's the obvious way, which is to just write C++ JavaScript code that manipulates whatever language, manipulates the XPCOM interfaces. There's a pretty rich set of interfaces that are exposed by data sources and individual nodes for getting properties and navigating the tree. Most of the time, what you want to do is display this data. And there's a handy widget written by the esteemed Dave Hyatt, written three or four times by him, actually, that displays RDF data in a tabular or tree-based display. If you're familiar with file managers and so forth, you know, just a little plus you click to expand the tree, that sort of thing. It does columnar stuff, and I'll show you the syntax for doing that sort of stuff in a second. There's a new feature as well, which is a much simpler syntax than the one I was familiar with until hours ago, which is templates, which allows you to have a little more control over how individual records are displayed and what you putting separators in and highlighting different areas depending on various parts of context. So this is what you write. This is actually Zool code. Tree and tree row, tree cell are entries in the sort of the part of the Zool XML dialect. So you can see here we've got a tree, and it's the bookmarks tree, and it uses an RDF data source called bookmarks. And when an item is clicked, we're going to call this JavaScript function, which is defined wherever in the file. We're going to have a tree. We're going to have the top of it's a pretty simple example here because the one with the file we took this from, bookmarks.zool, we're like, oh, we'll just show them how we do a bookmarks menu. But it's like 41K, and it would have been about 50 slides. If you're not bored now, you would have definitely been by the end of that. So we have a button at the top. We have we show what the column is here. You'll see the RDF resource names an assertion, and the tree widget works by checking each of the resources for a given assertion, and it'll display the value of that assertion, the value of that property, essentially, in that column. So whatever the name of the bookmark is. And that's defined within the Navigator client, I think that's what NC stands for, vocabulary, which is used for a lot of the Mozilla internal resources. And then the second last line here is tree children says, the ref, that's the name of an RDF resource, which is exposed by the bookmarks data source. So it says, start the tree here. Show all the children of it in expanding tree form and so forth, and it's open to start with. It uses a special magic assertion property called child. Imagine the name URI there, but replace name with child, and it uses that assertion to indicate inclusion and nesting within the tree, so you get subtrees within it. You can add child resources, and it will magically update, because Dave Hyatt's a very good magician. So it looks like this, and none of you can see it, because it's this tiny little image. You can see we've got, so this has three resources at the top level, sample FTP. That's a good guess what the next one is, sample something. And then personal toolbar, which has a bunch of URLs in it. And you can see they've got more columns displayed here. So each of those columns entries correspond to an assertion on the resource, which is all managed by these magic data sources underneath. All of this gets merged. You could have a local file system appear if you moved it into your bookmarks. It would use a different data source, and as long as it obeyed the basic conventions of the name and the URL and added on dates and the child relationship, it would get magically added to the tree. A lot of magic involved in RDF. It's actually quite clever. So you got all this magic power of RDF, and I'm sure everybody has interesting data. Everybody will pretend at the very least. They have interesting data that they might want to reflect in Mozilla. Pet project of mine, when I get some free time, is to write an RDF data source that reflects the bookmarks or the URLs that are on the GNOME desktop, and it'll put it in a special entry in your bookmark area. So as you drop stuff on the root window, it'll appear there, and if you file a bookmark there, it'll create something on the root window, just integrating a bunch of data sources. So you have to write code to do that. And here's the code you have to write. Copy that down. There's actually a pretty good document, if somewhat incomplete, on the Mozilla website that doesn't have to work in huge fonts and so forth. So it has a much more detailed example. The basic work you do is to implement this one magic interface. Magic, called NSI RDF Data Source, and it's the representation of your data stream essentially, and its job is to convert from whatever the native data format is, local file system, the XML serialization format, LDAP, whatever else, into this model that RDF uses to merge and sort and graph and make David Hyatt happy. So the basic, there's a lot of commands on the RDF data source, and I'll list some of them here. In order to keep you from having to write 60 different little functions, you can use this nifty tool of aggregation that my other brother Mike talked about, which will let you use a built-in memory data source and let it do most of the RDF magic. You just have to populate it from your data. It's a lot easier. So the first one you have to worry about is has assertion, and that's where RDF will ask you, the RDF engine will ask you, do you have this, do you know anything about this property on this node? So you say, you know, this directory, does it have a child? Yes, it has a child, and it's this set of things. And how does it get those set of things? It'll call get target, which will say, given this node and this property name, what's the value, basically? And it's all assertions and nodes if you're talking to a W3C member, but it's really objects and properties. And you can also go the other way. You can say, given this specific assertion and this node, what got me there? So you can go back up the graph, which is handy for doing stuff as well. For moving things around within the graph, especially, you can use it to reroute stuff. The call assert is used. You can drag stuff around in the tree widget, and there are other tools for manipulating the RDF graph. When the RDF engine detects that somebody's made a change in your data source's world, it will tell you somebody has asserted this. Someone has added this link between resources, and you can go then and move a directory on the, make a symbolic link on the local file system, or move something around on the website, refile a mail message. Arc labels in and arc labels out is sort of the, it's what I, when I was used to run websites for a living, I always wanted a way, long before Alta Vista, of finding out all the pages that linked to this one, because I'm going to change the where I was going to change where it was. I needed to tell everybody where it was now. Arc labels in tells you, given this node, what are all the things you know about that talks to this thing? So it'll use that. It'll talk to all its data sources, and you can get a list of all the places in your Mozilla system that refer to this bookmark. Which is more useful for doing underlying engine stuff than UI, but can if you don't, one of those things that you'll use infrequently, but when you use it, you'll realize it was very hard to do without it. You can go the other way as well. You can say from this node, what are all the properties you know about on it? In addition to the basic graph operations, which are pretty rich, there's a notion of RDF commands. There are some operations that are specific to a data source. You might have, if you're reflecting a remote FTP directory, you might want to have a way of refreshing. You don't want to have to remove it and re-add it. You want to tell the data source underneath, go and make sure the contents of that directory are up to date, or re-summarize my mail folder, or get my new mail. And there's a way for a data source to say, for this node, I know about these commands, refresh folder, purge, that sort of stuff. And the UI can then reflect that. I believe it does it on the context menu from the right mouse button. But your UI is free to do anything of that sort on it. So if you implement all of those, and most RDF data sources don't implement get all commands. But again, it's one of those things where if you're doing specific behavior for your data source, it's very, very handy. In the general case, you probably won't need to use it. If you implement all of those, you have a pretty rich data source, and you can use it with the tree widgets, make it appear in your bookmarks, make it appear in the menus, merge it with other data sources, that sort of thing. So I mentioned vocabularies before. Vocabularies are, they're vocabularies. They're sets of naming conventions for describing certain kinds of things, the same way biology has a vocabulary, and physics has a vocabulary, and open source developers have a vocabulary. Different RDF domains have different vocabularies. The Dublin Core, whose purpose has nothing at all to do with the name, I believe it was developed in Dublin, was developed by the W3C to describe electronic resources. So it has a notion of who the author is, and the site, and the protocol you use to get to it, the last modification date, generally used for cataloging internet resources and that sort of thing, a lot of librarian sort of stuff. Mozilla has a lot of specific characteristics it cares about, bookmarks and component information, special containment rules, folder data, that sort of stuff that we put in a vocabulary, which is NC, either stands for Netscape Client or Navigator Client. It was a toss-up when I asked which it was, so I like Navigator Client better. I'm going to try and make that the real one. So there's these existing vocabularies, and some of them are magic in that the tree widget, for example, wants you to use certain properties from the Navigator Client vocabulary for child to express nesting and whatever names you use for the columns. But in your own vocabulary, if there's other things you need to express because of your data source, you can make up your own vocabulary. When you do make up your own vocabulary, and you will have to in some cases when you get this far down the RDF road, you need to be careful that you're compatible with the other data sources you want to merge with. Merging is a very hard problem to do when you don't share a vocabulary. So you pretty much have to make sure that some of the key resources, name and location, child, are the same in your vocabulary as in, you know, for your data source as they are for everybody else, because that way you can interoperate. You can sort on common keys. You can search on common keys. It's harder to search across multiple keys and describe an equivalence. Just because of the nature of data. There are ways to do equivalences. There will come a time, RDF isn't hugely well deployed now, which is saving it from this problem, but at some point you will have data sources that one was developed and the other was developed without looking at the first one, and they have two names for the same thing. And there are plans to develop an equivalence mechanism within Mozilla to let you use those data sources together. that time will come and we'll be glad we did it. So if you have a platform that doesn't have Mozilla on it yet, and somebody just added OpenVMS to the ports list, in spite of an unfortunately broken linker, case insensitivity, there are three big things, Mr. Christopher, that you have to port. One is the Netscape Portable Runtime, which abstracts threads and I/O synchronization, dynamic code loading. It hides platform deficiencies, like Solaris at one point had a broken queue sort. The Mac doesn't do dynamic libraries the way you'd expect it to. Some platforms don't have mmap. It hides all that stuff underneath so that the programmers can use a rich and sensible API for talking to whatever platform. And it's the basis of the Navigator client through prehistory and through many of the servers. Porting NSPR is sort of your first job. Without that, you can't build a lot of things. It's not terribly difficult, mostly threading and locking code, defining the sizes of types on your platform. If you're using a Unix-like platform, there's very little work that needs to be done. The next thing you have to do, of course, you want to display stuff on the screen, is port the XPFE code to your widget and graphics interface, GFX. GDK, Qt, Motif are underway or done. People are doing Photon and OS2. If you wanted to do Nano GUI or something, you'd have to write the code that lives at this layer and translates between XPFE interface calls and your implementation. Widget itself is becoming less important because we're rendering more and more of our widgets natively, as Mike mentioned before, where we draw with 2D primitives, boxes and lines and colors and images and so forth, because HTML4 and our own UI concerns for the Chrome of the browser require certain things that are not readily available in a lot of platform widgets. So to get common behavior and common appearance, we have graphics widgets. And it also lets us do stuff like consistent themes. You can write a Chrome theme that'll look the same on your Linux box as on somebody's Windows machine and so forth. So once you get that stuff ported, you can start to pop stuff up on the screen. You'll be limited at that point by the absence of an XP Connect port. Mike talked about the fact that we use direct method C++ method invocation and C++ object impersonation, those are very big terms, to allow other languages to talk to the C++ implementation so it looks like a C++ object and so it can kick C++ objects in ways they're familiar with, requires some code to be written for sort of the cross-product of your platform, your architecture processor type, and your compiler's vtable layout. So there are a couple that are done for, there's one for GCC 2.72 on Intel Unixes, and there's one for EGCS. There's probably another one for Solaris Native on Intel, that sort of thing. So there's a small amount of assembly code that needs to be ported. Typically, you could probably write it all in C, depending on what your compiler characteristics were. Most of it so far has been written in assembly. Small, two files. The paper lists URLs to go to find out a lot more, including the status of various projects to port the code. Somebody recently did the Linux ARM, so that may or may not be updated on the list. You can go there and find out more about the actual details and look at all the sample code that's there. So as we were writing the paper, and as we were writing the slides, and as I was running over all, we discovered there's stuff that's coming in now that will sort of affect the landscape. One of them is called Necco, which is the new network library. The old network library was designed to work in a sort of a different event model, a different world. It had some reliances on old behaviors, some performance issues, maybe familiar with DNS blocking, window goes gray, get a coffee. Should all be fixed now. You heard it here. So Necco is landing, being integrated into the tree now, probably literally right now, over the course of about a week or two. So it also makes things like pluggable protocol handlers much easier. You can add your own magic network protocol. You can take Gopher out, because really. And that's landing now. Performance improvements because of the better, it cooperates better with the threading model, that sort of stuff. In M8, we shipped, for the first time, a semi-working, mostly working version of Christopher Blizzard's Xlib port of Mozilla, which uses just raw Xlib underneath to render widgets and layout images and colors and rectangles and stuff. It's quite cute. So you don't need a toolkit underneath, which is handy to avoid the whole toolkit religion issue, but also handy for embedded cases and that sort of thing. One of the other good things you get out of it is we have a lot of Unix toolkits. And they all really want to render HTML the same. They want to use their own widgets, so they have their own menus and their own scroll bars, and they may want to have various window behaviors that are magic. But they all really want to render HTML the same way. So using Chris's Xlib rendering code, and he posted a really cute, if somewhat hard to build, sample on the news group a little while back, you can now use the XLib rendering code within the toolkit of your choice, which is pretty neat because it means you can get your Qt or Motif or NanoGUI if it uses NanoX, your Athena port up and hopefully back down very quickly just by using all of this XLib infrastructure. And on top of that, Ramiro Estrugo, the tireless, has been doing some very interesting work that lets you select which toolkit you will use at runtime. So you can decide, I want to use GDK, I want to use Qt, I want to use Motif, I want to use raw XLib by a preference or an environment variable right now, a preference soon. Pretty sick. Maybe you'll be able to switch it at runtime. A little more challenging. You have to reparent a lot of things and re-render stuff, a lot of state that gets lost. You could do it. Okay, Chris is going to do it. He'll have a demo of that at the party tomorrow. So you're able to do a lot of stuff. Plug makes it easier also. Right now when you build Navigator Mozilla, you have to select your toolkit. And in order to change, you have to rebuild. Rebuilding is bad. That's the whole basis of our pluggability story. So now you'll be able to, some silly person will ship you a Motif toolkit version, and you won't want to use that. So you'll plug your GDK toolkit thing in the right spot. It'll do the right thing. Or Qt or XLib, whatever. So I think that's everything we have. I'm sure there are questions. Mozilla is a pretty broad topic. We were discussing earlier how we really could have an hour and a half talk about each of those technologies if we went through with, large code samples and covered a lot of the details. So there may be questions left that where we cut the wrong corner, and we're happy to answer those. You might have a question. Give your hand up.
What about memory usage?
Yeah, it uses memory. A lot of Mozilla's data is stored in RAM. Some of it isn't unstored frequently enough. There are memory consumption issues. I was reading an entertaining news message about the Neko landing status, and it said, we've turned it on now. We did some performance testing. It was encouraging. We were only able to keep it up for 5-10 minutes until our build machine went out of RAM. There are known issues there, and they're being worked on. Scott Collins recently wrote a document about ownership of objects, talking about weak and strong references, and fixing stuff related to that, making sure you understand the ownership model. Ownership and memory management of this sort of stuff is sort of complicated, as we're discovering. And the priority so far has been to get features in place, because in a lot of cases, the way we're building on top of our layout engine and our other components, other groups are blocked waiting for features to happen. But there is a crusade, and a quite religious one, led by Bruce Michener, who spends about 80% of his waking hours in front of Purify, I think, to get the memory usage down. There are people who are quite seriously, without any iron at all, talking about Mozilla in embedded contexts, cell phones and PDAs and machines with less than 32 megs of RAM and that sort of stuff. Right now, I don't recommend it. If you have an 8 meg 486, it's not going to be a pleasant experience for you. I can't pretend otherwise. I can now build and run Mozilla in debugger on my 128 meg box. Most of that memory is actually used by GDB, but I can do it comfortably now. The memory footprint's been going down. It will jump back up when Neko lands, because a lot of assumptions about how data went away with network contexts is changed. But yeah, people are going to solve those problems. It's the software. I hate having to say this. At some point, we're going to be finished it. At some point this year, and I won't have to say this more. But it is unfinished software, and there are prioritizations made there, and people have made the decision that getting these features in so we can make sure they work and that we really want them was more important than rigorous attention to memory leak issues. So right now, leaks that happen really quickly will tend to be fixed. Leaks that happen, you leak 100 bytes every time you click on a URL. People aren't paying it. I mean, we have all of that's on our radar, and there are bugs filed about all of it. And if you find a leak and the bug isn't reported, you should absolutely file one. But people aren't as concerned about that stuff at the moment. It was a really long answer to, yes, we take a lot of RAM. Anyone have a question I can answer more quickly? You, sir. You don't actually mean the hardware.
No.
The Macintosh. Yeah, I have a Mac now, so I understand what you're talking about. And it's cold. Yeah. 5.0 on the Mac right now is until you run out of RAM. substantially faster than 4.5 in a lot of cases. On X, it's not because of some repaint and reflow issues that were actually fixed. Some of them were fixed yesterday, I think, by this team, Scott Collins. It was an interesting CVS message. Fixed the box reflow code, made Linux suck less. It was kind of nice. In the Mac case, there are a lot of bright people working on that. There were some people talking about Mac performance at the Mac hack recently. I'd be very surprised to discover that it wasn't mind-bendingly faster than 4.5. Even on the old, the classic code base, before we made the giant switch to NG layout, 5.0 was faster than 4.5 and 4.0. So Mac performance is definitely an issue. One of the reasons that we made the switch to the new layout engine was performance. And the layout engine itself is pretty quick. The problem is that in a lot of cases, the rendering implementations on the various platforms haven't been well optimized. But there are a lot of people who are very, very fervent about their Macintosh, and I am sure that they will do the right thing there. And if not, I haven't said this yet. I have an incredible restraint. We're taking patches. And you know, if there's a certain operation that's a lot slower than you think it should be, being able to narrow that down is helpful. Being able to submit a patch or file a good bug can help that stuff along as well. So if there are specific, I don't know if there are specific operations you're concerned about within Mozilla that are slow now, or whether you're just suffering through a slow 4X client. But either way, we should get better. I just realized the questions aren't being taped as well as me. I'm pretty bright today. The question was about stripping Mozilla down to make an active desktop sort of thing. Mozilla will render in any X window. So you could probably do that now. What you need in terms of stripping it down depends on what you want there. You can run just the layout engine, is pretty small in terms of disk footprint and theoretically RAM footprint, although right now it's a little bit hefty. If you're already running the browser, being able to render an additional window on the background it doesn't sound technically challenging. There'd be some desktop-specific infrastructure that you'd have to write to integrate with whatever else, but it certainly doesn't seem infeasible. In terms of how small you can get it, we have a news group called performance.sizematters, and there are people in there who are very much concerned about, you know, how small you can make Mozilla and have it still do all the interesting things, like correctly lay out all these forms of HTML and XML and stuff. I would be surprised to discover that nobody did that, actually, by when we ship 5.0. I expect there will be some active desktop sort of background. Mozilla as a screensaver was discussed. I think people were a little intoxicated, but it was discussed. So there's a lot of ways you can do that. It'll render on any sort of thing in the Unix world. Now, I presume you're asking about that because of the conference. If you want to do it on Win32, you can probably actually just fake the existing Active Desktop implementation out a little bit and use the Mozilla renderer instead of IE. That actually works. It's kind of a neat demo to watch IE rendering with the Mozilla engine and not knowing it. So that should all happen. I really got to be quicker with these question answers.
I'm using the microphone because I'm not sure how I state this as a question. When you were talking about XPCOM, the cross-platform stuff, have you looked at Corba? Because there was I don't know how to state this as a question.
Why did we use XPCOM? Doesn't COM really suck? We get that a lot. I wonder if that's the question.
No, that wasn't the question. Okay. The question is, have you looked at using Corba? Because it seems like you're doing many of the same sorts of things.
Yeah, Netscape has a fair amount of experience with Corba. We shipped more orbs than anybody else in the world when we shipped that silly Java orb with 4X. And one of the problems is fast, portable orbs. We'd end up writing our own, and doing Corba stuff requires a lot more infrastructure than... I mean, we could do a subset of Corba the same way we did the subset of COM, but that probably wouldn't solve the problem in terms of being able to interoperate with all these Corba things. We can't fully interoperate... can't do all of the things you can do with Microsoft or DCE-COM in XP-COM, and similarly, it'll be a subset of the Corbett implementation. There are very fast orbs now. Orbit is a very good example of that. I've been told it's the fastest orb in the world, but I was told that by the developers. So we could use that sort of thing on... It'd be possible to build this component architecture on top of anything, and as we start to use the IDL stuff to generate more interfaces, which is actually based on Orbit's libIDL, we could do that. I think a more interesting... We had to pick a technology, and we chose XPCOM, and there are probably good reasons to have chosen Corba, and there are probably good reasons to have chosen XPCOM, and we went with XPCOM for reasons that are now of only historical interest. If you want to use Corba to build your application and you want to talk to Mozilla, you can do that if you're willing to write a little code. Writing an XPCOM to Corba bridge is not an impossible thing at all, and people have talked about that. You have to do stuff with interface repositories to populate from your typelib data, and you have to marshal back and forth. But XPCOM, the use of it is designed to handle crossing process boundaries and crossing thread boundaries. The Java VM runs out of process. Give me more. Okay. Michael?
My question is somewhat two-sided about some way standard. I have a big beef with ISO 8859 character set handling whenever you receive things. And I'm wondering if there's more support for not just supporting multiple character sets, but making sure that messages and things sent or web pages posted or published actually do have the character sets that they say they do.
Are you referring to the Windows question mark?
Windows
issue?
Question mark.
Yeah.
That's right.
So the problem there is it's really impossible for communicator to tell if this person really did want to use a question mark in all those places. Well, in that case, there's no code point for that value, which is why you get the question mark. So you could do some detection. If you're talking about content that's generated by...
If I believe someone used Netscape Composer and all of your problems would go away under Windows...
Don't tell them that yet. Yeah.
All of your composing problems would go away and you'll get real characters.
I believe that to be true.
It's not true.
No, it is certainly it is wildly untrue in 4. People wanted to use smart quotes, and that's where that character comes from. You copy from, so you a lot of it's copy and paste, data coming through the Windows copy and paste API, and we just have to guess what the character set it is. Is it the local? Because you ask, is this the native character set? And they tell you what it is, and then your preferences say, I publish documents in ISO 8859.1, and so you believe them, which is obviously the wrong thing to do. In the Composer that's being written now, it's a lot more sensitive to what character set's actually coming in, and it will label things more correctly. There will always be cases where the data is represented to Composer as 8859
sure,
and is something else.
128 through 159 are just invalid in 8859.
Yeah, there's some auto-detection magic in there now to do. There's some detection code there to do. Are you sure you've got this as the right character set, or this MIME header doesn't make any sense, so we're going to try and figure out what it is by ourselves. And that code could be adapted for that purpose. But I believe Composer does label things, the current editor does label things correctly.
No.
It'll label it with CP109 or whatever it is if you wrote with the Windows code page.
Lying, that's all.
Yeah, lying is bad.
I really need to know the right code page if I really needed to see what they were talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, it's a quote, yeah. I'd be very surprised to discover that it didn't do the right thing with character sets. One of the things that we did new in 5.0 was a totally new localization and IE10N infrastructure. And there's a whole news group for it, and I'm sure they would answer your question much better than I have. But
and
I believe that's their intent.
Is the frame support such that it's a little more easy for the user to cope with stupid things that people have done because they didn't understand the standards and then Mozilla didn't
frame behaviors, bookmarking frames is hard, TM. I don't know how the bookmark mechanics work. I suspect they work the way they work now, where you bookmark the top-level document. Frames in HTML4 are a little different. There's no notion the frame set is deprecated and so forth, so if people start to write, they're going to write code using embedded HTML regions and so forth, that's going
to
change. Yeah, so you're asking a capability question now. Is there a preference for that? There isn't currently. It wouldn't be a huge hack to make the layout engine say, I don't know about frame tags, if you set a preference the right way. So that's certainly feasible. We're still taking patches.
Okay.
We'd want to do it in a general way. There's a related question people ask, how can I disable frames? How can I disable new window creation, window.open, various parts of the status bar? God, don't let them touch the status bar. There are people at Lucent, I believe, working on a generic capabilities model for specifically JavaScript, but will be used for other parts of the browser as well. So people will say, only sites from these domains are signed with these certificates if you get a Mozilla spawn that's got crypto. only these sites can do these operations. So nobody can open a window with JavaScript unless they're from, you know, my intranet uses that to pop stuff up maybe, so that's okay. So that the frame set capability might work there. You may know that the content on your local network knows how to use frames and that it does something clever with them that you like. So you allow it in a per domain thing. But I don't think the preference is there yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, sensible cookie handling is already there. I like it. I like that kind of question because it's done. Yes, sure. Per domain, you can edit it on the fly. I want to send back a different cookie than the one I got. Web application designers are going to love that. because they always there's actually support in Communicator 4 JavaScript cookie filters where when it was about to accept a cookie, it will call a JavaScript function in a page you provide, and you can decide there, accept this one, don't accept this one, prompt me. And that's the facilities for that are a lot more UI friendly in 5.0. Yeah, there's a lot. The cookie handling is pretty rich, and you can do all sorts of damaging things to your applications with that.
How extensible is Composer to arbitrary XML DTDs such as, say, MathML or SVG? Can you match a MathML editor?
You were sent by them, weren't you? Question is about using Composer to edit generic XML. The Composer itself is a big Zool application. So you can edit a lot of stuff within there and teach it about new tag types and new dropdowns and so forth and character handling. You could write that code. Whether Editor, the Composer, as shipped by Mozilla, the base 5.0, or by Netscape or Neoplanet or whoever else will do that out of the box, I'm not sure. The intention is that the Editor classes that are there are pretty generic and can be used to, you know, generic XML, HTML-like markup. I don't think the editor team is aiming to do generic XML in the first release. They just sort of pick their target. The MathML guys, on the other hand, are making pretty interesting progress on rendering it now, and they've talked about wanting to do editor integration. So the facility is certainly there. We wrote an HTML editor on top of the Mozilla framework. You could certainly write a MathML and SVG editor on top of that. Whether you could do it in a generic way, I'm not sure. I understand there are generic SGML tools. I'm not an SGML sort of weenie, so I don't know a lot about that. But there's a lot of power there. It wouldn't be trivial. It's not going to be a preference, I don't think. But there's a lot of facility there. And if you had to add something, I believe they'd be pretty receptive to taking those changes. Are we done? No, of course not. Sir. Yes, they do now, somewhat.
Somewhat. Yeah, again, the question was, will XBCOM objects be able to talk to MSCOM objects? That was not one of the goals of XBCOM to start out with, but on the same token, we really tried to make sure that in future it would be possible, and we didn't try to become too divergent from MSCOM objects. Right now, we're running into this problem with resolving shortcuts on the desktop, because you need to make a COM call to do that. So we're looking at ways of doing that and either making it, we probably won't make it so that you can transparently from any XBCOM object call into COM or vice versa, but try and sort of minimize the part of Mozilla that knows about COM and can call into it. Because, I mean, part of the problem with COM is that it's only really on Windows. I mean, it exists for Mac, but I don't think anyone's really taking it too seriously and building stuff on top of that. So no, I guess the answer is yes, it will talk to it in some sort of limited fashion, but there aren't currently plans to make it fully compatible between XBCOM and COM.
There have been developers have written code that bridges the two universes. Adam Locke wrote an ActiveX component for Mozilla, and that talks from COM to, obviously from COM into XBCOM. People have gone the other way to talk to various parts of the Win32 environment. We didn't do anything to make it explicitly incompatible with, I prefer to call it DCE-COM, but we all know what I'm talking about. So our base interface, NSI supports, looks surprisingly similar to iUnknown on Win32 and so forth. There are a lot of things like co-classes and apartment-based threading models and so forth that aren't provided yet, and we're not quite sure how it's going to interact. Shared allocators, maybe, maybe not. But in the base case, you can certainly write code that will talk to COM that'll run on your platform, but I don't know if it's ever going to work in the universal case. Yeah.
And I guess it's also worth pointing out that our VTable format and stuff like that is the same as COM's. On Windows, at least.
Yeah, on the Mac, it isn't because the debugger doesn't like those objects, so right now it's not. Euler? Sir.
What's your shift day? And time.
Yeah, and time. They sent you, didn't they? So they want to know what our ship date is. My standard answer, which isn't helpful at all, but I'll give it anyway, is when it's ready. I mean, we could have shipped already. Nobody wanted that, least of all you. The schedule for the milestones is published on the website, and we've stuck to that except where we haven't. I think they pushed M7 out a week because of Necco issues, and they wanted to make sure it all landed. There will be a Mozilla-branded beta, in the summer. So I remind you, the last day of summer is September 21st. And it may be Eastern or Pacific time, depending on whether I make the call or someone back at Netscape. But beta in the summer, will ship a 5.0 in 99. There's a lot of work still to be done. I mean, it's a lot of software to build there. We've all seen what happens when you release internet browsing software before it's fully cooked. Couldn't use 404 until, you couldn't use the 4.0 clients on Unix until 404, that sort of stuff. I mean, they had to ship then, so all sorts of good reasons for it, but we want to do code when it's ready, and we're sort of trying to do a different model. So we'll ship something in 99 that'll be 5.0, that'll be Mozilla. Whether Netscape ships, if you're asking me a Netscape question, I will laugh politely and ask the next question, but Mozilla will ship a 5.0 in 99, barring an act of God. We'll ship a beta, like you could use this every day sort of beta, in the summer. So there isn't that much longer left, right? You've got 7-8 weeks left in summer, and it's starting to come together pretty well. Not everything will work, of course, it's a beta, but yeah, beta in the summer, final in 99. People, if that changes or as it changes, well, you hear about it all over Slashdot, because I'll be there defending myself, but you'll see there's stuff in the news groups and there's stuff on the schedule posted. You asked a question with the word Netscape in it, so I'm actually supposed to go and hide and call people back in California now. Netscape is building a 5.0 client, I believe that they will call it Communicator, on top of Mozilla. So it will not be the same code, I'm virtually sure of that. Things that have been suggested as additions to Mozilla that would make it a Netscape-branded product include Java, built-in or bundled, Netscape branding, Netscape images, integration with the website, some binary-only plugins that various third parties have deals with them for. Crypto, everybody loves crypto. We can't do crypto. Everybody points south and boo. There may be other stuff. There may be features that are in Mozilla that Netscape decides not to ship. That's perfectly their right. There are features in Mozilla that Neoplanet's not going to ship. There are features that I don't know which other companies are publicly announced yet. Other companies are going to ship portions, neither a strict superset nor a strict subset of Mozilla. The big differences will probably be that it'll have a little N in the corner. Netscape's going to provide QA services. I mean, that's one of their value adds, is they're going to do, you know, additional testing beyond just the way we do it, right, Chiz? Our users test it for us, right? Same way, you know, Linux and Apache get tested. And there will be crypto and Java sort of stuff in there most likely. It's hard to say. I try not to find out a lot about Netscape products because I would be forbidden from talking about them. And in the cases where I would have guessed right anyway, I'd rather just be able to guess. So I can't. If you're interested, there are people at Netscape who would love to answer that question almost for you. And you can talk to me afterwards and I'll give you email addresses and so forth. Michael?
I'm wondering if there's any facility to talk to proxy servers using ICP or things like that, so desktop can get involved.
There aren't I can guarantee you categorically that there's nothing of that nature in there now. Support for additional network protocols and extensions to the cache should be well supported. We know a lot of people want to do stuff like ship a CD-ROM that is a pre-populated cache. They want to be able to talk to caching servers. They want to be able to update their proxy settings based on information they get back from the caches, that sort of stuff. There's nothing in there now, but the architecture should support it, and where it doesn't, it's a bug. So that's going to be a common answer to that sort of question. I give that a lot, and I should talk a little bit about why. I'm going to publish a document about this on Monday. There are about 150 people working on Mozilla, a large number of whom work for Netscape, AOL, conglomerate. The developers pick what's in the code, right? So there will be a lot of features in there that like HTML rendering that Netscape really wants to see. There'll be features that companies, you know, people from Sun want to see, features that people who are porting to QNX want to see. They'll write the code, it'll go in if it's good code and it fits with our vision of what the software should be. Additional features, it's possible to, there's a couple ways to get it in there. At the end of the day, someone has to write the code. You can write it yourself, which I encourage wholeheartedly, and if there are questions about how to do that, it's my job to answer them. You can find a company that might want to do it and encourage them to do so. They may be doing it for another product, maybe doing it in another domain. Mozilla is the right way. We all know that. That's why we're here. You can pay someone to do it. It's hard for me to say, I mean, I say a lot, I really like that feature. I hope it's in there, but I can't. I don't have enough time to write all these features myself, and I try not to keep developers from doing the stuff they really don't work on. So it's, I'm sort of in a hard position to answer that sort of question. I'd love to see it. I want Mozilla to be all things to all people, but I can't guarantee anything will be in there. I can guarantee we'll provide infrastructure, but that's about it.
What's your recommended development environment to people who want to write code?
Which platform? Are you asking for a platform choice as well? Unix? I heard a disturbing number earlier, which was that you need 750 megs to build the tree, but I'm sure that's not true. CVS tree, there are ways to, there are magic configure options. Uh-huh. Secrets of the CVS masters. Disable static. Cut your build side tree in about half. If you're going to run it under a debugger, you need about 128 megs of RAM. That's what I do my work on. I use a Pentium 2 266. I use a slow IDE drive in my laptop. This laptop, I believe. Yes, this one's mine. It takes about 35 minutes to build from scratch, 45 minutes, depending on what you're building and how well parallelized it is. I use XEmax, I use EGCS, GDB, that sort of stuff.
I don't need to buy a new drive.
You shouldn't, no. It depends on what you're developing now. If you're currently developing, embedded applications, you might need more disk space. If you're developing for GNOME and you want to switch, you've got all the disk you need. They're both big pieces of software. People doing kernel development are dealing with smaller build thing.
That's what I want.
Yeah, it's going to be a big number. He doesn't build with disable static. He's naughty. I have 2 gigs for my entire installation, and I have the web tree, and I can actually build in there if I delete like kernel source and stuff. It just fits everything in that, so you should have enough space. I think your box is frozen. You better shut it down. It's a lie. It's a cruel and hurtful lie.
It's gone, okay.
Doing -j on its own, any damage suffered to your machine is not my problem. I build -j3. There is one, it will occasionally, because the NSPR build system doesn't do all of the things the rest of the Mozilla build system does, it will sometimes die on some strcpy.c file. You just restart, it's fine. But I build with J3 all the time. 800 megs. That's only one tree, too, isn't it? You don't have GDK and xlib in there, do you?
Yeah, I do that for both of them right
now. So only like 770. Disable static. I blew my tree away a little while back because I was dumb. Sorry?
A gig of disk space makes you happy.
Yeah, gig of disk space makes you pretty happy. You can save your core files. That plus a core file gets you close to a gig. And yeah. So yeah, 128 megs is, you can never have too much RAM. I develop with 128 megs. There are tricks you want to play with GDB to have it not load every shared library in the universe into memory. There are tricks listed off the Unix page to keep, because there are a lot of shared libraries and they have a lot of symbols in them. Selectively enabling debug. He also doesn't selectively enable debugging, and that's like the maximum size, right? I'm getting a little defensive now. Constrained by our universe. Yeah, are there GDB hackers here? You can admit to it. There are GDB users here, right? Still don't see any hands. Okay. Any more questions? Are we delaying the keynote yet? Not yet. So we can do more questions. And I can answer more questions later. I'll be around at least till Ellen's keynote's over and we get to a bar. And yeah, news groups and email is, sorry?
Demo.
His box has the demo box. Do you have a clean tree?
I have a tree that works, yeah.
Okay, so what kind of demo do you want to see? We're talking, yeah, we can show you. Okay, I should ask this. I took this for granted because you all came to the silly talk. Who here has seen Mozilla running? Oh, sorry, that's stupid. Who here hasn't seen Mozilla running? Damn. Yeah, Chris, fire up Mozilla. Fire up App Runner. What the heck? I'm feeling lucky. So, Chris, do you have a tree that works? Oh, there you go. I give Chris a hard time. But. Component registration, see, component manager, XP Connect. That's those ugly numbers you don't have to type all the time. So that's why you use prog IDs. This is good. Oh. Maybe it's not going to render anything. It's not going to do the tests? You want to be able to browse the tests? Ooh. Open the sidebar. Oh, that's it's really that? I can do tests without a network. Do tests at 30,000 feet. Oh, this is going to be, yeah. Table tests. There we go. So it does HTML. Thank you. We're done. Oh, actually, if any of you have done CSS work with Communicator 4, you'll notice that some of the stuff that was up there is hard to do, lines above things and colored strike through and stuff. So, wow us. Let's not see the DHTML demo. Still have some performance issues in the Linux rendering. Can you show the drop-down animated GIF? We may have to restart App Runner.
You guys will be supporting PNG natively?
Yeah, we do already. It's already there. Uses your system library if you have it installed, otherwise it uses a copy in a tree. Yeah, test 16. But you need to set, do you have the preference set for graphics widgets?
I don't know.
This is what we do all day. We make fun of Chris all the time. It's quite a sickening demo, so I'm actually interested in seeing it run here. Ng-layout, widget.mode2. Yeah, somebody's working on preferences, Alan. Actually, that's going to be the default shortly, probably for M9. Even the scroll bars. And the window, the menus that don't go real slow now.
What is that feature?
Which?
The two thing that you just did.
Oh, that turns on. That's it. It's just the test mode. It'll. The GDB guys asked us to put it in. They're going to use it part of their regressions. No.
Quick, take notes.
The.
I can show you. I just got
to rebuild viewer with X11. I'll answer other questions. The feature here is rendered using the Mozilla rendered widgets rather than native widgets into form elements. Because for one of the things that's on that, I don't want to give away the surprise because it's really quite appalling. And I hope I never see it on any other web page. Yeah, it's not the full effect unless you can see all of the pieces moving, though.
Yeah.
HTML 4 lets you put arbitrary content and arbitrary form widgets and so forth, I believe. Anyway, we allow it. So you can put like things that you wouldn't want to put in text fields. You can have partially opaque text fields on top of partially opaque animated graphics. You can. Doesn't mean you should. Don't let me encourage you in that direction, but you certainly can. We could run Viewer with other demos. Sorry? What kind of machine is that? Yeah. What are we?
I don't know. Yeah. Zach, what machine is
same as mine?
P2300.
In fact, apparently, it just hauls butt on Win32. So, there's some. Once we get some rendering issues dealt with.
Are you using MingW on Win32 or native?
No, native MSVC. Although this really sick man named Christopher Seawood is making it so you can cross-build Win32 from Unix platform with like Cygwin and MingW and whatever it is he uses.
It's not that hard.
Well,
I'm
it.
Just wondering what you should run your
Oh, we don't. We have a separate makefile set up for. We have three build systems. One for the Mac, because they use binary project files.
Yay.
Thank you, Code Warrior. We use MSVC projects, and we use and makefiles, and we use
autoconf,
except for NSPR, which has to be different.
Oh,
it uses its own.
So there's autoconf working then NSPR.
Yeah, but it hasn't
almost
in the tree yet. So.
Yeah.
Might as well not be there. Are you using J3, Christopher? I wanted to show the nice man that it. No, don't stop it. Good God. yeah. So, there are other questions? This will only take a second. Is this a good idea, starting viewer while you're building the other graphics library? Could it conceivably get confused?
Oh, now we're still building GDK, I'm going to run viewer with
Of course. Right, all right. So, there we go. Viewer. This is the Xlib work that Chris did that we shipped in M8, although I think this is actually a little better than what's in M8. Well, a little different, anyway. Yeah, text fields. Someone do Xlib text fields? I think it wants a URL. Oh yeah, I can appease the crowds. Where are the shirts? Craig, where are the shirts? They're outside?
Yeah.
So how many people do you figure in this room? I just wonder whether you have to run or not. There are about 300 Mozilla shirts out at a desk somewhere. Sorry?
We were saving the candy till the end.
Yeah.
You
got
300 more?
No. I'd have to take the leftovers home. I'm going on a train, and I got a box, and they're big. No, I don't have 300 here. They're there, yeah. Are there any left?
No.
Yes.
I need one answer. Oh, there are probably like three mediums left, right?
Yeah, I know, probably like one medium. I have a lot of extra letters, so I mean,
oh. It's always interesting to go to a conference and see the mix of T-shirts that get picked up in terms of sizing. It varies a lot. Sprightly little hackers here. Okay, we're going to show this, and then you can cut my mic and drive me off with the hook. They asked for it, really.
This is the most courageous demo I've ever seen.
I really just wanted an animated GIF of the whole thing spinning through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's because I haven't really pulled a lot of the library.
Yeah, that's fine. Anyway, I highly recommend you fire it up. I'll tell you what it is, just so you'll want to go and see it. There's this drop-down select box with animated images in it. It's really quite breathtaking. You can do all sorts of nifty stuff, but you can't do that, obviously, with native drop-down widgets on a lot of stuff. Are you flashing a signal at me, or are you taking a picture? First, I thought that's how they were telling me it was time to get off the stage. This guy's blinding me every 45 seconds. So that's it. I'll answer more questions later, in a bar or here or whatever. Send me email. Thank you all for your time.